Chapter 9. Crimson King. The City of Grey Flowers. Blessed Lady. Colchis is a thirsty world. Depending on the speaker, those words were voiced with a smile or a curse. But they remain true. The continents were raw with thirst, and the world itself was marked by memories. At three times the size of Terra, with a fraction of the population, it took almost 5 standard years to turn once around its merciless sun, and it turned with great patience, a day lasting a Terran week, a week lasting a Terran month. From orbit, its skin was a visage of unforgiving mountain ranges and auburn desert plains veined by threading rivers. It was in dry lands like these that humanity's ancestors, the very first men and women on the world no longer called Earth, rose in lands that would become known as the cradle of civilization. Colchis was aboriginal in the same way. Mankind had been born in lands kin to those blanketing its surface, making Colchis an Earth that might have been, rather than the Terra that was. Over the generations, civilization had spread itself thin across the arid continents, with most cities clinging to the coasts. Each city-state maintained links to the others through sky trade and ocean freight, on a world where roads across the desert plains would be little more than folly. Unlike much of the emergent Imperium, Colchis was unprotected by vast orbital weapon platforms. More tellingly, it also had little in the way of the industrious space stations responsible for feeding and refueling parasitic expeditionary fleets in their crusades through the galaxy. Colchis still bore scars of long-forgotten greatness, an age of wonders ended in fire. In that sense, it was a future echo of what Kur had so recently become. The world's surface was bruised dark by the bones of dead cities fallen in unrecorded ages, never resettled. New cities rose elsewhere with the genesis of a simpler, quieter culture. The ancient ruins suggested a machine-driven empire once ruled Colchis, though little evidence ever came to light regarding its destruction. The Lost Kingdom's legacy was evident even in orbit, where drifting dead hulks, locked in orbits that would still take millennia to completely decay, marked the graves of interstellar shipyards. Few Imperial fleets ventured near Colchis, and not merely because of its lack of resupply capacity. Rumours circulated, citing unreliable shipping lanes and the disappearance of the 2188th Expeditionary Fleet in a nearby region added fuel to that particular fire. Colchis seemed a world focused upon looking inwards, even backwards, refusing to clear its skies of wreckage from the dark age of technology and resisting all Imperial edicts to establish new orbital bases. The planet's one concession was to allow the Mechanicum of Mars access to those serene hulks, letting the tech priests plunder whatever they desired. And they'd done just that, with great enthusiasm, for great profit. The region was not haunted. No Imperial commander would ever give voice to a laughable superstition when such words were holdovers from a more indecorous age. Yet still, Colchis saw scarce traffic, and its resistance to supplying the Great Crusade remained inviolate. It was said this defiance could only have come from Lorgar, the Emperor's 17th son, for no other authority would allow a planet to remain so curiously provincial. In the capital city, Varadesh, a golden plaque was fixed to the immense doors leading into the Spire Temple of the Covenant. This tablet marked the Primarch's supposed words, words he'd never admitted, yet never denied, speaking to his father. "Take me from my home, and I will sail to the stars of your empire. I will serve as a son must serve, but let Colchis stand as I have shaped it, a planet of peace and prosperity." It was also said, by the few that witnessed such rare moments, that the Primarch smiled each time he passed those words and reached out to stroke his golden fingertips across the etched lettering. Colchis was hardly devoid of technology. It enjoyed the benefits of Imperial life and culture, despite its master's hesitance to supply materiel for the Emperor's war. Auspices in the sky traffic towers of Varadesh tracked the activity in orbit, with scanner consoles lighting up at the sudden pulse of so many signals. It had been many years since the Urizen returned home. This time, there was someone waiting for him. The ship bore a proud title, named in honor of a legendary city in the murky tides of Prospero's complicated mythology. The Sekhemra was the only live vessel in the heavens above Colchis, and it rested in its geocentric orbit, weapons unpowered, shields inactive. The humble strike cruiser seemed content to wait in silence, bathing its red hull in the fierce illumination offered by the system's sun. Reality opened in an uneven rent, and the word-bearer's fleet streaked across the void, great engines also streaming light into the darkness as they powered towards their homeworld. On the strategium of the Fidelitas Lex, the Lord of the Legion watched the red ship's resolving image on the oculus. He smiled and closed his eyes as emotion threatened to overtake him. "Incoming hail!" a bridge officer called. "Open channel," Lorgar replied. The smile didn't leave his face when he opened his eyes and the oculus projected a grainy image from the opposing vessel's command deck. The pict revealed a giant in unprepossessing black-stained mail armor, surrounded by his own bridge crew. His skin had a dark, coppery hue, as if he spent many long days under alien suns, and his helm bore a scarlet plume of cresting hair. One eye was sealed, puckered shut from an old wound. The other glinted with a color that couldn't be made out through the image's distortion. "A trifle melodramatic, brother," said the giant in an amused baritone. "That many ships, when I only brought one." "You came," Lorgar said through his smile. "Of course I came. But you owe me some answers, dragging me across half the Imperium like this." "You'll have them, I promise you. It lifts my heart to see you."
"And mine to see you. It has been too long. But brother,"
the giant hesitated,
"there was talk of Monarchia. Is it true?"
The smile faded. "Not now," Lorgar said. "Not here."
"Very well," said Magnus the Red. "I'll meet you in the City of Grey Flowers."
Life always struggles in the desert. On Colchis, as on many of the Imperium's driest worlds, the indigenous life coped with the climate however it could. For the human population, it was a matter of coastal cities, immense water filtration facilities, irrigation farming, and dealing with the seasonal floods from the rushing rivers that acted as blood vessels for the arid plains. Varadesh, the holy city, was the nexus of such industrious efforts. Swathes of irrigated farmland reached out from the city walls, a triumph of ingenuity over nature. Colchis was a thirsty world, but the perfection of the human form showed in all things. For other forms of life, lacking the capacity to affect their own environment, adaptation and evolution went hand in hand. Many plants in the drought-racked scrubland had leaves with a layer of fine hairs to catch and hold more moisture from the infrequent rainfall, and as a defense against the wind's drying touch. Colchis demanded much from its native life. These forms of plant life had been catalogued by Imperial scholars over the years, and promptly ignored. All except for one wildflower growing in the alluvial deserts, a flower that couldn't be dismissed so readily when it meant so much to the Colchisian people. The moon lily bloomed with leaves of silver, white, and grey, all to reflect more of the sun's harsh light, stunting its own photosynthesis in the name of survival. Fragile, beautiful, the moon lily was a gift between lovers, a decoration at weddings and festivals, and those trained in its breeding and care were as respected as teachers and priests among the populace. Across balconies throughout the city, especially on the spires claimed by the Covenant, great hanging gardens of white and silver blooms contrasted against the tan stone walls. Varadesh was the imperial designative name for the capital, and in the ruling caste's religious sermons, it was referred to with passion and pride as the Holy City. But to the people of Colchis, Varadesh would always be the City of Grey Flowers. Its wide streets were filled with cheering crowds as the legion returned home, and when the first stormbird, a vulture of gold, roared in for a landing by the Spire Temple, the people flocked to see their Messiah return, and the pilgrims he brought with him. Argyltal was approaching this carefully. He wasn't sure how she would react.
"You will have to be careful on the surface," he said.
It had taken 4 months to reach Colchis from the ruin of 4716. 4 months of flight through stable warp conditions, 4 months of training and prayer, 4 months of listening to Zaphen debate about the old faith and what hidden truths might be contained within the legend of the pilgrimage. Argyltal wasn't sure what he believed, and the alien presence of doubt left him cold. He'd spent much of his time with Cyrene, as well as drilling the 7th Company to battle readiness and dueling Aquilon in the practice cages. The custodian was a nightmare of an opponent, and both warriors enjoyed the challenge offered by the other. They weren't even close to being friends, but grudging admiration was a fine foundation for meeting each other in the dueling ring. With the 4 months of travel to Colchis added to the rest, Argyltal and the Chapter of the Serrated Sun had been absent from their own expeditionary fleet for well over half a year. From what little word reached him, apparently the 1301st expedition was sending repeated pleas for the Serrated Sun to return, for they were locked in a vicious compliance that required Astarte's aid to break the enemy. Already one of the smaller fleets, they were apparently grinding to a halt without their legion contingent. One of the messages had been addressed to him personally as Chapter Subcommander. It came directly from Fleetmaster Balok Torvus, a veteran of Void War, but self-confessed at lacking insight into planetary engagements.
"We're hurling men at one of their mountain strongholds, but they hold every advantage of terrain, and our armor divisions are ground down by ambushes in the foothills. Would that you were here, Subcommander. The blades of the 7th would make brutally short work of this place."
Argyltal had saved it in the Data Slate's memory archive as a form of penance. He sometimes brought it back up to read over, masochistic in his frustration. Soon, though, they would return to the Great Crusade once breaking orbit from Colchis. The Primarch had business here, and in truth it was a blessing to be able to return to the home world. Argyltal hadn't been back himself in 3 decades.
"I said you will need to be careful on the surface," he repeated.
Cyrene had changed. Gone was the emaciated wraith who wept as she left the ashen remnants of the perfect city. "I don't understand," she said. Her sightless eyes were closed, a habit she'd unconsciously been forming in the past few months. As she spoke, she was arranging her hair in a fashion that seemed needlessly complicated to Argyltal. Her hands moved slowly, carefully, sensing by touch what her eyes couldn't see. He enjoyed watching her. It was something of a guilty pleasure. While nothing of attraction existed between them, he often found himself captivated by her fragile, gentle movements, as if she was forever careful about affecting the world around her. She seemed to want to leave no mark, no imprint on anything she touched. There was no fear in her grace, no hesitation, simply respect, care. The captain stood in full armor, but for his helm, leaving his head bare, so the voice she heard was his own, not his helm's. Cyrene was slowly learning to differentiate his voice from Zaphon's, mostly through their accents. Argyltal had a rough, almost impolite edge to his guttural intonation, whereas Zaphon, born in the Urals on Terra, had a clip tendency to turn S's into Z's. The chaplain spoke like a foreign diplomat, the captain like a ganger or a boy living on the streets.
"What don't you understand?" he asked her.
She toyed with a lock of hair as it lay against her cheek. "I don't understand why I have to be careful." This was a difficult subject. Word from the Legion fleet was constantly cycled back to Colchis, for the people of the home world took great interest and great pride in the conquests of their chosen champions. Mothers and fathers listened in the hope some chronicle would detail the glory of a son taken from them in childhood and reshaped as one of the Astartes. Covenant clergy listened for inspiration to preach of the Primarch's righteousness. This network was maintained by astropaths, sending short psychic pulses of information back to their counterparts on the homeworld. Several times a week, broadcast from speaker towers across the Holy City, updates of the Legion's progress drew flocks of listeners. Citywide celebrations were declared by the Covenant each time a Legion expedition reached compliance. Everyone, everyone, had listened to the reports of Monarchia, the Legion's humiliation, the word-bearers kneeling, the Emperor destroying the Imperial Creed forever. The fleet's return had an uncomfortable gravity about it, for despite the population's joy, the whole thing reeked of so much more than a simple homecoming. And then there was the matter of Monarchia's survivors. The Legion had encountered few living souls in the ruined city, and Cyrene was one of only 7 people taken from the devastation. Word of these holy refugees flashed through Colchisian society. Here were living martyrs, drawn from the ashes of the Legion's shame. The Covenant sent entreaties to the Legion fleet, pleading with the Primarch to allow the refugees to set foot on Colchis, perhaps even to be inducted into the Holy Order itself. The 7 names were already being spoken with all the reverence of saints' titles added into daily prayers. It was difficult to explain this, because Argeltal had only learned the extent of the refugees' fame an hour before. The chapter of the Osseous Throne made planetfall shortly after the Primarch, and the 4 refugees with them were mobbed by adoring crowds. Their every word was recorded, their names were chanted in the streets, while people sought to touch their skin in the hope of gaining some of their divine fortune. Vox reports immediately stabbed back to the ships in orbit, warning the other chapters harbouring refugees that the City of Grey Flowers was as eager to see the Monarchians as it was to welcome the Primarch home. "You have to be careful, because there may be some people on the surface who seek your blessing and approach you without warning. It might be disorienting." Her serf's robe was a simple affair, but she smoothed it carefully against her returning figure.
"I still don't understand. Why would they want to see us?"
"You are an icon," he said. "A living icon, a martyr in life rather than death. You paid the price for Colchisian ignorance, and in doing so earned great respect from us all. I'm told they are saying the 7 of you are tied to the Legion's destiny, a reflection of failure, a hope for the future. Your life is a lesson, and one we must all learn."
She faced him without seeing him.
"That's very poetic for you, Captain."
"It is the best way I can describe it."
"I'm an icon to them."
He donned his helm, staining his sight blue and adding a layer of targeting information to his vision. His voice emerged as Vox growl.
"Not just to them."
The journey down to Colchis lasted 20 minutes. In the Thunderhawk's cockpit, Argeltal stood behind Malnor, the pilot. They came in low over the parched earth, approaching the mud-brick city walls as the desert sliced past beneath. The city's skyline showed a breathtaking view of tan buildings, brick spires as far as the eye could see. To the south, the great river Phranes flowed past, a wide road of sapphire glinting in the sunlight. River barges and bulk freight carriers crossed on the wide waters.
"Legion gunship Rising Sun, this is Western District Control. Please respond."
Argeltal scowled behind his faceplate. This didn't bode well.
"They're keen," said Malnor, and reached to activate the console's voxponder.
"This is the Rising Sun, inbound."
"Rising Sun, please confirm you have the Blessed Lady aboard."
"The what?"
He deactivated the channel and looked over his shoulder.
"Captain!"
Argeltal swore in breathless Colchisian.
"I think they mean..." "This must be a joke," Malnor uttered. "My blood's running cold," said Argeltal. "This is no joke." "This is the Rising Sun," Malnor voxed again. "Repeat, please."
"Rising Sun, this is Western District Control. Please confirm you have the Blessed Lady aboard."
"I don't know," the sergeant grumbled. "That depends on what you're talking about."
The voice on the other end of the Vox channel explained and assigned landing coordinates accordingly.
"This," Malnor said to Argeltal, "is getting out of hand."
The captain nodded.
"Be ready. You've just volunteered to join the escort detail. By your word.
The Thunderhawk shuddered as it graced the landing platform.
I hear something,
Cyrene said. She stood in the gunship's loading bay, flanked by Zaphon and Torgal.
It's the engine cycling down, said Torgal, knowing full well it wasn't.
He'd seen the view from the cockpit window as they came in on approach, and like the other Astartes, his enhanced hearing could clearly differentiate between engine wind-down and the sounds outside the hull.
No, she said. No, it's voices. I can hear voices.
Argeltal stood ahead of them, ready to hit the door release and lower the gang ramp. Malnor came from the cockpit, thudding his way down the crew ladder. He saluted Argeltal as he took up position behind the Monarchian.
You might be disoriented, Cyrene. Argeltal's vox voice almost made the words a threat. Do not fear. You will be between the four of us at all times. Malnor behind, Torgal to the left, Zaphon to the right. I will lead the way. It is only a short journey to the monastic spire where you'll be staying.
What's happening? She asked.
All four warriors could hear her heart beating faster now, a wet drum behind her ribcage.
What's going on?
There's nothing to worry about, said Zaphon.
They were the last words he spoke before donning his own helm.
We will be with you.
But...
You'll be fine, Argeltal said, and thumped the door release.
Sunlight flooded into the loading bay, as did thousands of cheering voices.
It's going to be a long day, said Torgal.
Torgal's prediction proved correct. Cyrene was shaken by the day's events, no doubt about it, but the Astartes believed she'd held up well. Colchis was a world of peace and law, and the City of Grey Flowers respected its holy leaders above all. On more barbarous worlds, the Monarchian refugees might have been besieged by adoring crowds in celebrations that bordered on riots, but here they were cheered from the side of the roads, with the petals of moon lilies cast onto the ground before them. Upon first leaving the gunship, Cyrene had lifted a hand to her mouth, almost staggered by the wall of sound that rose to meet her. Zaphon lightly rested his gauntlet on her shoulder in reassurance. She'd heard Argeltal a few steps ahead of her, swearing in a language she didn't understand. And then they were walking. In the bellicose good cheer, she lost the second of her senses. After growing used to perceiving the world around her by sound, to have everything washed away in the crowd's noise was a frightening loss. Several times she reached a hand out, her fingertips brushing the cold metal of Argeltal's back-mounted power pack.
Are they near? She asked.
The crowd sounded close, so very close.
They won't touch you.
She thought it was Torgal's voice, but through the helm filters she couldn't be sure.
We are between you and the crowd, little mistress.
Definitely Torgal. Only he called her that.
Will they not touch your armour, she asked, for good luck?
No, it's against tradition.
She was certain that was Zaphon, but he said nothing more. The crowd continued to chant, sometimes her name, sometimes her title.
How many are there?
Asked Cyrene, her voice small.
Thousands,
one of the word-bearers said. In the clash of noise it was difficult to tell where their voices were coming from.
We're almost there.
That was definitely Argeltal. She recognized his accent, despite the helm. The captain couldn't entirely swallow his unease. It lingered, coppery and unwelcome, on the underside of his tongue. Target locks flitted from peasant to peasant as he scanned the crowd, row upon row of celebrants lining the street. So much for a meditative homecoming.
Sir, Malnor voxed, oath papers. Permission granted. Thank you, sir.
Malnor broke ranks, walking towards the crowd. The closest citizens knelt as he approached and averted their eyes. Without ceremony, though with obvious care, the sergeant untied the parchment scroll bound to his right pauldron. He rolled it up into a scroll and offered it to one of the kneeling peasants. An old man took it in hands that trembled. Whether they shook with emotion or palsy wasn't clear, but the silver wetness in his eyes was testament to his devotion.
Thank you, great lord,
the elder said, and pressed the gift to his forehead in thanks. Malnor had another oath paper bound to the shin of his armour. He removed this next and offered it to a woman, who quietly wept.
bless you,
she whispered, and touched the scroll to her forehead, just as the old man had done.
From the fires of righteousness, Malnor intoned, unto the blood of purity, we bring the word of Lorgar.
By your word, the nearby peasants chorused.
Malnor nodded his helmed head in acknowledgement and walked back to join his brothers.
What happened? Cyrene asked. Why did we stop?
It's considered a blessing to be offered the oath papers from our armour, said Argeltal.
A few minutes later, Argeltal paused the march again to give one of his parchments to a young mother holding a baby. She pressed the scroll to her infant's forehead, then her own.
What is your name, warrior?
She asked, needing to crane her neck to look up at him.
Argeltal.
Argeltal, she repeated. My son will carry that name from this day forward.
Insofar as it was possible for a walking suit of battle armour to look humble, the captain did so now.
I'm honoured, he said, and added, be well,
before rejoining the march. Torgal glanced down at the frail figure of Cyrene.
Would you like my oath scroll, little mistress?
He offered.
I don't read very much anymore,
she smiled, bright and sincere.
But thank you, Torgal.
After the short march through the streets she couldn't see, Cyrene had spent the rest of the day in one of the Covenant's temples. Argeltal and his officers remained with her as she was interviewed and questioned by over-eager priests. Instead of being given a seat, she was guided to recline on a long couch made almost princely by too many cushions. It had the opposite effect of the intended one, leaving her shuffling to get comfortable no matter how she reclined. In the end, she just sat up straight, treating it like a chair.
What was the last thing you saw?
One priest asked.
Describe the fire that rained from the sky,
pressed another.
Describe the city's towers falling.
As the questions went on, she wondered just how many inquisitors were sat before her. The room was cold, and the faint echo when people spoke suggested a large chamber. A background hum pervaded everything, a thrum that set her teeth on edge. It was one thing to recognise the active buzz of Astarte's armour, but another entirely to get used to it.
Do you hate the Emperor?
One of the priests asked.
What happened in the months after the city fell?
Asked another.
Did you kill any of your abusers? How did you escape?
Would you serve the Covenant as a High Priestess?
Why did you refuse the Legion's offer of new eyes?
The answer to this last question intrigued her interrogators a great deal. Cyrene touched her closed eyes as she replied,
On my world, there is a belief that the eyes were windows to the soul.
They answered her words with muttering unintended for her ears.
How quaint,
one of them replied.
Do you fear your soul would quit your body through hollow eye sockets? Is that it?
No, said Cyrene,
not that.
Please enlighten us, blessed lady.
She shifted in discomfort yet again, and still blushed each time they used the title.
It was said that those who wore false eyes would never move beyond this life to paradise beyond. Our mortis priests always preached that they could see the trapped souls of the lost and the damned in the false eyes of servitors.
There was silence for a time.
And you believe,
one of the priests said,
that your spirit would be sealed within your corpse if you surrendered your natural eyes?
She shivered to hear it put like that.
I don't know what I believe, but I will wait until they heal. There's still a chance they might.
Enough!
A voice boomed, edged by Vox's crackle.
You are making her uncomfortable, and I've given my word to the Urizen that she will be taken to the Spire Temple at midnight.
But there's still time for...
With respect, be silent, priest.
Argeltal stepped closer to her, and she felt her gums itching at the drone of his armour.
Come, Cyrene. The Primarch awaits.
May the Blessed Lady return tomorrow,
one priest piped up as they were leaving. None of the Astartes answered. Once outside, another crowd was waiting for her. She smiled in the direction of the noise and offered the occasional wave, feeling her face burn with self-conscious doubt. First and foremost in her mind was the effort to keep her discomfort from showing. There would be no getting used to this. She knew she'd hate it until it either stopped of its own accord, or they left Colchis behind.
We didn't have to leave, she said. I could have answered more questions. Was I supposed to?
Over the din of a crowd, she heard Argeltar reply,
"My apologies for using you as an excuse to leave," he said, "but it was too pointless to endure any longer. Questions that led nowhere or were already answered in the Legion's reports. Tedious bureaucracy propagated by self-important men."
"Is that not blasphemy, defying the will of the Covenant?"
"No," said the captain. "It was a tactical retreat in the face of overwhelming boredom."
She smiled at that as the word-bearers led her on. Less than 3 minutes later, as Cyrene was drawing breath to comment on the warmth of the desert night's wind, there was a crashing sound from above, the crash of 100 windows, smashing at once. What she couldn't see was all four of her warrior guides standing utterly still, staring up at the Spire Temple, that twisting tower of tanned stone, central in the city, taller than all else. Around her, the crowd's cheers soured into whispers and weeping. Two of the Astartes, she didn't know which, began to chant prayers in monotone vox voices, benedictions to the Primarch.
"What happened?" she asked.
"Move," Zaphen ordered.
One of them gripped her elbow and forced her into a run. Their armor joints snarled with the change of pace.
"What's going on?" she tried again. "What was that noise? An explosion?"
"The Primarch's observatory on top of the central spire," he said. "Something is wrong."